Well, that's like the strange loop phenomena. I came across that actually in the 50s when I was writing my very first book. I came across a comment by the, now names are escaping me completely these
that's
days.
Right.
Names, I just have to refer to, but a very famous scientist who said, when we look at the tremendous discoveries which the humans made in a very short period of time, understanding the universe and planetary systems and all the rest of this, said it seems that man's mind is just a mirror of the universe. And I was delighted to hear this. I was working on my book Crack at that time. That was the main feature of Crack. I had answered, yes, man's mind is a mirror of a universe that mirrors man's mind. Each gives rise to the other. You can't have one without the other. But that arose from a very misguided scientific idea, and yet could be used to our advantage. And that was it, that man's mind is a mirror of a universe that mirrors man's mind. In the, I said, for instance, that a scientist who gets fascinated over some great problem and riddle will spend years and years studying, and finally, like Marganita Lasky writes about, has his great eureka experience. Ooh, ah, finally the answer. He sees, and it's finally published as this great new discovery in science. But it was not a discovery of a previous structure. It was a discovery of a structure of thought that science had brought into and then fed into enough to bring it into reality. And this is a different ballgame, and that's where we get into the strange loop. I picked up that from Douglas Hofstadter obliquely in his book Gödel, Escher, and Bach. He's a great physicist. And he didn't actually use the term, but he pointed toward the strange loop effect. And he said that science would not go near it because it was an embarrassment to the whole scientific community, that they preferred never to look at. And I said, well, that's what I was calling man's mind's the mirror of the universe that mirrors man's mind. And I had a chapter in my first book called Mirror to Mirror, that when we look at ourselves in space, it's a mirror. And one of the ways in which I tried to explain that, and I don't know why I couldn't get anywhere with it with most people, there is no creator without a creation. The creation brings the creator about. The creator is meanwhile bringing the creation about. We've been snowballed, I mean brainwashed by science to think you must have a cause and an effect. There are many, many effects in our life all the time that are not caused by anything. They're effects brought about by the relationship of mind and its reality. And I've been in that ever, all these years. It's been the real heart of most of my books, howling about the... And people say, oh, yes, we create our reality. I say, nonsense. We don't create our reality. We enter into the creation of a reality. And there's a huge difference. One is a massive arrogance on the part of the human being. And the other is the recognition that there's this huge universal intelligence. In fact, I've gotten a kick out of the argument between the Darwinist in the schools.
The creationists.
The creationists. That's the silliest argument ever in the world. For one thing, they don't know Darwin at all.
That's right.
Darwin's first book was a brilliant work. Oh my golly, a stunning book. And took had to do only with the the bringing about of such a massive number of different creatures from this same little protoplasm in the ocean, and that Darwin's whole first work was on that brilliant idea of his. But the second book, which he wrote in the most important and great part of his life, has been totally, radically ignored. If you would stop a thousand people on the street and say, "Are you familiar with Darwin?" "Oh yes, Survival of the Fittest." Everybody knows Darwin, Survival of the Fittest. We've all just monkeys and believing in a tooth and claw civilization. We all at each other's throats all the time. That's because of our inheritance that we inherit. But Darwin's whole second half of his life, he was a very, very religious man. He considered, very much considered, the clergy in the Anglican Church. And he was torn between his love of biology and his love of the church. People are not aware of that. But at any rate, in his second great work, Darwin showed that the survival of the fittest of ordinary classical thought could only take you up to a certain point and no further. And to bring about the human being required the development of love and altruism. And love and altruism are the two additions to the evolutionary process, which then could bring about the human being. And he went on in another part of that same great work of his second work. He had spoken, now wait a minute, let me get this straight. Oh, had spoken of care, the care and nurturing and protection of those who are less fortunate than ourselves is the great mark of the human being. Now, how are you going to fit that in with the tooth and claw survival of the fittest Darwin? No, one represents Darwin in that early period of his life, and he was exactly, of course, everyone's always correcting him, but he was essentially correct. Took that little ride around the planet, you know, with Cook and did that beautiful work, brilliant work from it, then settled down in his garden there in England, raising his bees and flowers and so on and so forth, on his second great work. And he called that the descent of, what was it? Oh my God, I can't believe I've forgotten that. The descent of man, perhaps. Origin of species, but the descent of man. And he states it out very clearly. Man descended from the two great forces of love and altruism. Altruism, care and love of your neighbor. So it's typical that science, material science, would embrace Darwin 1 and reject Darwin 2 altogether. You never hear of him. He was buried immediately when he came out with his second book. They just buried him. The whole academic world did. They loved the Origin of Species, Survival of the Fittest. The whole British empire was on Survival of the Fittest. How many people can we subjugate? In fact, they referred to the white man's burden as most of the rest of the world. And then the great capitalistic movement was just getting into swing in the later 19th century. And in capitalism, of course, you have dog eat dog, every man for himself, the devil take the hindmost, and that's the way it should be. Darwin says so. And this was, they brought in that neo-Darwinism, they call that. And it was a vicious and terrible thing to do, and not even recognizing the real Darwin. So I've forgotten what all that was about anyway now.
was about all the wonderful work that you have done in association with bringing forth that second half of his, the second part of his life.
Yeah.
And sharing it with the rest of the world, because look at the things that you've written in The Magical Child. When you think about how do we expose our children to things that allow them to be the full expression of themselves.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Magical Child was a good book, and it did a lot of good things. I was proud. I think it too. Also, it was my biggest seller.
Oh yeah.
Brought in more rent money than anything else. But and that was based on a very good observation of both myself, my own children, and just childhood in general. There's this incredible thing blooming. And it's nipped right in the bud. Now, I had no idea, even when I wrote Magical Child, how thoroughly we nipped that in the bud. And this new book, I've brought it out. And a lot of that I brought out in 1990 in my book, Evolution's End. That was really a better book than almost anything else up until this present one. That was a splendid book. In which I mean, from my standpoint, in which I point out that the heart, I'm talking about the physical heart, is a source of intelligence. Mind, brain, is a source of intellect. And intellect, without the balancing forces of intelligence, simply runs amok and creates what we have today, a terrible mess. That was my point. We will straighten out the intellectual mess we have made only by a return to the intelligence of the heart. And the intelligence of the heart sounds oh so sweet and la-di-da. But we're talking about a very real thing, and this not really until the last couple of books have I gotten into all of the genetics and actual structuring of the heart. And how it is the source of all intelligence, but not intellect. And people say, well, what's the difference? All the difference in the world. Intellect is an act of the mind in trying to outwit the whole show and nature and so on. Intelligence arises from the heart and refers only to the heart. But this is, everybody says, ah, la-di-da, hearts and flowers. But we're talking about a very real and vital thing. I was delighted with the work of Heart Math Institute, which you're familiar with. Mm-hmm. And I was introduced to them when they first settled on that mountaintop there off California's coast. And I've watched them ever since. Heart Math was really onto something very strong. Dr. Luchilder was a genius and a great person. They eventually, to my way of thinking, and I would say this with great caution, went astray. And that is in the great temptation of anyone discovering the source of true intelligence is to try to use it. No, you can't. Heart Math was discovering all sorts of things about the radiations and frequencies coming from the heart and from the brain, etc. They made one error there in the mistaking the message for the messenger. All these signals they're picking up, all these electromagnetic frequencies that create the arcs around it, it's all that business, and you've seen those pictures, no doubt, are simply the messengers. They're not the message. The message is pure intelligence, which has no effects of that nature at all. And they decided that if they could have everybody with one of the little gadgets, and that would keep them in touch, in sync with their heart at all times, then the human being could simply alter the whole history of the planet and cosmos, etc., etc., entering in as chief planetary engineer and so forth. And their error in that was, again, the error of mistaking the messenger for the message. The heart is the source of spirit. And we're not talking about spirit la-di-da here. We're talking about the creative spirit of the whole universe. And it really does manifest through the heart. And there's only one heart. People don't realize that. Billions of little brains and egos up here, but only one heart. My great teacher, Mukhananda, over in India, I spent about 10 years, all my winters and some of my summers, in his ashram. And we were meditating on the heart the whole time. And you spend lots and lots of times in true opening up to the intelligence of the heart, and things happen in your life that will never happen any other way. We had one course over there in India called the Blue Pearl Course, because they found that if you're really concentrating on the heart all the time, you get verification in a brilliant little blue pearl of light which will appear. And blue light was always considered a sacred light anyway. Well, I had never heard of the blue pearl until I got to India and took their blue pearl course. It was 30 days in meditation, going in before it was light in the morning, coming out after dark in the evening. Whoa. And 30 days in concentration on the heart. And this isn't child's play. It's a real discipline. And the things that can then happen can't happen any other way. So the Blue Pearl experience is for those who will do that kind of a discipline. I'm not saying it's the end all, but it's an indication of the validity of the interaction that's taking place. And my own experience, now for instance, I have been many times referred to as the anti-Christian Jesus freak, because I find all sorts of faults with Christianity, like the Muslims. I think they're pots calling kettles black, and both are a tragedy to the human history. And I'll probably get shot. Well, no, I've been expecting to get shot for a long time, haven't yet. But in my own life, I've had vivid, fairly frequent, remarkable experiences of the person, what gives every indication of being of Jesus. And in fact, how I met Mukhananda was through that very, very outlet. And in that respect, I'll tell you one quick thing that will explain this. I was working on my book, Magical Child. The what's that order? The Jesuits had given me a little retreat cottage on the mountain overlooking Los Gatos and what do you call it? Silicon Valley. And it's right at the edge of an evergreen forest. I mean, a great one of those huge trees and a vineyard. And this it had no electricity or anything like that, a little retreat cottage where I could write finish working on my book, Magical Child. They just gave me that to live in. And I had tremendous experiences in that. And I was working on the issue of play. And I knew play was the great secret, not of childhood, but of life itself. But I didn't know how it worked out and how to fit it in. And I've been working on this for months and months, reading everything I could on play, that Hungarian with the impossible name wrote the best and clearest thing on play I had found. And I couldn't make it come out right. And I'd been working on the issue of play for, I guess, 2 or 3 months. And that's a long time. Puzzling or reading everything I could. And I had all my notes about play. And finally, one night, this was from reading that Hungarian or whatever his name is, his book, and it was a key, and it sparked all sorts of other issues on the idea of play, and I got very excited about it. And I was in that same little cabin I was telling you about with a kerosene lantern, and I knew I was on the right track, and I was getting closer and closer and closer, and I'd been working on it for months. And finally, I couldn't make it work. I quit. I just quit. And I couldn't do it. And I put my hand in my, head in my hands and burst out with this very genuine prayer, "Oh God, what is the issue of play in our life?" And a bolt of, you talking about lightning, the most powerful thing I've ever had happen, hit me from the bottom of my feet, coming right up, and tossed me out into the universe, and I went tumbling over and over and over. Now I've had, I guess, about 5 experiences like that, but this was the most unusual in the way it came about. And so this incredible experience of this, and I suddenly realized that I was being played with.
Like a ball.
Like a ball. And I was being bounced from one part of the universe to the other, like a ball, going through these incredible, ecstatic experiences, one after another. And my daughter, who was with me at that time, 14, I think she was at that time, and she was in the hay, the little loft up above. But at any rate, I was shouting out, "God is playing with me," over and over, and finally it all began to wear down, and I began to come back to my ordinary self, and I wept. I literally wept the rest of the night with just this huge joyful gratitude over what I'd been given. But that's where my issue of play, the magical child, ended up, that it was the most critical of all issues in our whole life. It's all that counts about anything. And it's the message of the heart. The heart is play, pure play. Well, I'm going through all that because I've always written out of my own experiences. They're the only things I have that are valid to me. I like other people's ideas, and when they come and talk to me, I don't want to hear a parade of their ideas. I want to hear their experience. Mm-hmm. To me, experience is the whole thing, a heaviness, if you like. And so that was one of the big issues on my discovery of the heart and what the heart was all about. That led to my meeting Mukhananda. And Mukhananda is the one who said to me, "There's only one heart." And he said, "The one beating in my chest and the one beating in your chest are the same heart. There's only one heart." And he's the one who said, "Billions of little egos up here in the head, only one heart." One of the most incredible things I'd ever heard, and I was to discover exactly how true this was. And then the other thing was a whole theory that at the time was Rudolf Steiner and some other people, that the heart is the source of all creativity in the universe, that the entire universe can be found within the heart, and that it vibrates out of the heart many quadrillions of times, like the quantum or something, very rapidly, surrounding us, out of which the universe is articulated and created. So the whole thing comes from our heart. And this was wild-eyed stuff now. And yet, it was my experience over and over and over again that that's simply the truth. The heart is the source of all creativity. It's the whole source of creation itself. When we say God lives in the heart, this is an understatement. You know, that's what the whole show is about, is the heart. And the great trick is to allow, to develop the intellect all you possibly can in order to be an appropriate servant of the heart. But of course, what happens in the development of intellect, we assume that is what we're after, and lose contact with our heart entirely. And that's what has happened to us as a species. We've developed this tremendous intellect and lost touch with our heart, which means with the Creator and everything there is, and as a result are destroying ourselves.
So how do we get our heart back?
Oh, yeah. That's a good one. Here again, I have to fall back on my own experiences. But when I was about 20, out of the Army Air Corps, World War II, and home, I had a series of experiences. And I don't know how to say other than they're rather complex, but they were experiences in what Mircea Eliade, the famous Jungian, what do you call people who study other people, original anthropologists. A great Mircea Eliade was a very great psychologist, one of Jung's offspring, and at the same time, he spent many years with the lamas of Tibet. And he found, of course, that they, and his comment about this was so incredible, that they could, after their years and years of training, completely reverse the ontological constructs of our world. Now, the ontology is an explanation of how creation takes place, how our world forms around us. And the ontological constructs are the ways which we have concluded as a species the whole thing holds together. Fire burns. But the Tibetan lamas did not have to be burned by fire. 32 below zero, sitting out on a floor of ice, jaybird naked, drying out sheets that have been soaked in water, as Mircea Eliade witnessed in Tibet, was their final graduation test after 12 years of training. And this intervening in the ontological constructs of the universe was one of the principal things that Eliade had to talk about. I won't go into all the ways in which these Tibetan lamas could do this. Just incredible. They could ingest water up to their rectum all the way up.
Yeah.
Whatever it is, they could do the exact opposite of it. Now, once they had accomplished all this, and see, this is the awesome and very beautiful part of it all. Once they had accomplished the reversal of the ontological constructs, the way everything happens. They never went near the ontology again. That is, they never monkeyed with it again. Surefire doesn't have to earn. Once is all you need to find that's true. You don't just sit around there in a pit of fire all the time. The same thing, once you, it's like Judith Van Halle. Judith Van Halle is a contemporary German. She was an architect, came over and did her doctorate in architecture at New York University. She was also a follower of Rudolf Steiner. Now, there's an oddball. Lots of real question marks. He's quite a mystery man. She was a great student of Rudolf Steiner's and went back to her native Berlin to practice her art of architecture as a Steiner follower. And all of a sudden one day, she had the stigmata. And people, she was not Catholic, but she had the stigmata. And it did not go away. Now, people like our great, what was her name, the contemporary Catholic, beautiful one who had the stigmata, but only every Easter. And after the 3 days at Easter, the stigmata then would go away. And that's conventional. The first one to ever do this was the very famous saint. Why are my names? Once my name starts slipping, then fear of my name slipping brings them to doubt more and more.
Of course.
But first great one was the greatest, one of the greatest people of all times. But he had the stigmata. And then once it had happened, it happened more and more. But the Catholic nun who had the stigmata found that she never again had to eat anything. And she was, what's her name? The very famous, well-known Catholic nun. She was observed, they put her in the hospital, observed her for a couple of months under constant observation. The only thing she ever had to eat were the little wafers
from the church.
From the Eucharist every day. She had the supper every day and one little wafer. Now, if you have taken the Eucharist, that wafer's not much chow to go on. But that's all she had, and she lived from the rest of her life on just that wafer a day, and had the stigmata, but only at Easter time. But Judith Van Halle had the stigmata. It did not go away, and from the minute it appeared, she could not stand food. Her body reacted to food as to a poison. And now, this is a contemporary. My good friend Sardell has been over to be in her presence twice already. She's does her thing over there in Europe, in Germany. But Judith Van Halle has not eaten a bite since. And she pointed out, she said, if the human species only knew it, they did not have to eat to live, it would certainly
live longer.
Well, live longer, the medical profession would disappear, and so would most of the ailments plaguing us. But she's not the only one. Lots and lots of other people have been discovering that they could live without food. And it's just simply a business of learning to, it's fairly comparatively simple. The German head of a large chemical company in Switzerland, but he was professor of chemistry at a German university, and I'll think of his name in a minute. But he wrote a very brilliant book about following the so-called 21-day process out of Australia and never having to eat since. And he submitted himself to be under constant observation in a hospital for over a month, and they found, of course, that
he wasn't eating.
No, he doesn't eat. But an awful lot of other people have done that now. My next door neighbor right here at the Institute, what's her name? At any rate, she heard of the 21-day process, and a group of women here at the Institute formed a protective group around it, because you can't have any interaction with another person when you're doing it, but just make sure she was okay, and to furnish her the liquid she would need for the final part of the program. Up until then, no liquids. And when you go for more than 4 days without liquid, your kidneys start failing, and the body starts dying. But it doesn't if you follow this 21-day process. And Rita Fisher, a girl originally from Switzerland, was here, and a group of women here at the Monroe Institute, they just kind of kept an eye on her.
A vigil.
A vigil for her, yes, to make sure she was all right. And then when the time came, she would signal that she was ready to start and take some liquid. They would provide the liquid for her, but she couldn't talk to anyone or have any personal contact with anybody during the 21 days. And Rita came to it famously. I talked to her quite a bit about this, about the whole process. And finally, she came back several times visiting here. She's thin, but she said the freedom, the sense of freedom is so incredible.
Oh, sure.
From knowing that you are not subject to intake of food. I opened up this last little book of mine talking about mitochondria, one of the great mysteries of the world, and the role they play in this, and how this is a case in which the mitochondria can be bypassed and not even employed. The point of it, I forgot really what the point of it all probably was, but I guess the issue is what I've been hollering about all my life is we have these incredible capacities that we don't use. And what I found after the war was a series of these events happening to me. I wasn't trying to prove anything to anybody, but they just happened to me. And always with a small audience, at least a small audience, first in my college dorm, the one semester of college I had back then. And what can you do? Then you know something that you didn't know before. Now, my first discovery was that fire did not have to burn you. And this upset my dorm mates so much, the physics majors went down. They found that a cigarette, for instance, burns at 1380 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, you keep 1380 degrees Fahrenheit constantly in touch with your skin, something's going to happen, but not necessarily. And to find that really was true opened the gates to all sorts of other things. Again, I just stumbled into them. They happened to me. And were at first nothing more nor less than an embarrassment, you know. But I came from a very conventionally academic family, and both my brother was a college professor, my other brother was a writer and editor of the Louisville Courier Journal, won 2 Pulitzer Prizes for journalism, and all sorts of things. So they were very straight-laced. I mean, they were conventional thinking. And all my stuff was falling completely outside that. And so after these experiences of what I have written about, that is unconflicted behavior. unconfigured behavior happens when there is not 1 ounce left in you of conflict. Most of us, even most movement, your movements are checked by an impulse and all sorts of other counter impulses and so on. And this business of unconflicted behavior is when you have absolutely no conflict within yourself. What you're thinking, what you're feeling, what you're acting, what you're saying and all are one single response. And the things that can happen in a state of unconflicted behavior is simply the intervening and ontological constructs of the universe. So there, it was Suzanne Langer who said, the human's greatest fear is of a collapse into chaos should their ideation fail them. Ideation meaning how we make sense of our world and how we think it works. We inherit that ideation as our cultural heritage. And we have no way of ever doubting it when we grow up. We believe what our parents believe and what happened to us. But to discover that it's all negotiable is what has happened in many and many a case. And in most cases, then people try to do something, I want to tell you about this. It's the first thing you find no one wants to hear, because their ideation is put to test and it frightens them. So the first problem one has in this business of unconflicted behavior is to learn to go with it the instant it you can feel it take over. Instantly go with it with no question. If there is the tiniest flicker of a doubt, lose it. Mm-hmm. But if you go with it without a second's hesitation, it'll move you. It will breathe you, as they say in Zen. It will breathe you and move you. But even in the breathing and moving of you, there must be this radical surrender to that effect within you. And that's the human spirit. You know the physicist David Bohm? Mm-hmm. A great man. Oh, golly. And Bohm said one time, he was talking about true dialogue. A true dialogue happens when one person addresses another without any agenda at all. You drop all your agenda. Every possible reason of why you're meeting this person, why of anything. You just drop your agenda and open to the other person. And Bohm said, for instance, this can be practiced in a discussion, that you can pick up a certain subject and both of you get all caught up in it. And then at a certain point, if you drop your agenda and give yourself to the other person, now that sounds la-di-da. Bohm said a third force comes in that is not the sum total of the two intelligences, but a third force entirely.
I believe that.
And that breathing you gives you something that can't happen any other way. The Buddhists, the Zen Buddhists, were the ones who understood this probably better than anybody else. But we find that things like this are a threat to most people. Rather than seeing it as this way lies liberation. But the other thing about it is, once discovering this, there's never any need to do it. So you can then do what? You can play. You can play in the world rather than have to, you know, fit in, worry about it, and so on and so forth. You can just play. There is the source of pure play. And that's been one of the things I've really been fascinated with for many and many a year. But there again, it arises from, you can't convince anyone of anything other than your own convictions. Your amount of information, your arguments and so on, will never convince anybody. It's your own inner conviction that will convince others. And, oh well. Those have been some of my interests. And they came out really nicely in this last book, and I haven't been able to get that last book off the ground.
Well, we want to be sure and get a copy of it and have you sign it for us.
I should have brought you a copy. I'm happy to. I've got several left. But it was a very good little book. Robert Sardell had established his little spiritual publishing company, and I said I'd give him the manuscript to publish because he's a dear friend, and it might help his little publishing company. Instead, he couldn't get my book off the ground, and we talked about it, and so after he was published, even two or three books, you have no trouble finding a publisher. Well, this was my tenth actual book, when I'm co-author, and so there was no trouble in finding a publisher, but I picked Sardell's little Golden Stone Publishers, thinking maybe I could add to it somewhat. Instead, he couldn't move my book, and so finally, after I think almost a year, and we really hadn't sold enough copies to put in your eye. I talked over switching publishers, and so finally I switched to Inner Traditions. I know those people real well, and I've published a lot of other stuff. They published brought out nearly everything I've done. But I haven't worked out all the details of it yet. It was complicated. Not a new manuscript, but to pick up a book already in published form and bring it out under your own imprint was a different matter. This is about 2 months ago when I began a real downhill slide. I mean, my body tried to quit every way come Sunday. And I just couldn't manage it anymore.
And you had some grief come into your life.
What?
You had a little grief come into your life.
Oh, well, my brother's death a year ago was a tremendous blow to me. And for one thing, I was the last of a family of eight. And my brother was 6 years older than myself, and he had been kind of my mentor and my buddy, a dear buddy, and he was himself a very remarkable guy, and so I spent a lot of time with him, and when he died, I no longer had a frame of reference for any memory. I would think, oh wow, do you remember such and such? Wait till I tell Don. And all of a sudden, there's no longer anybody to tell. And all of a sudden, there's no other family to tell. Not one. I'm the last Pierce, there is. And I'm trying to get over this weekend to see my cousin Louise Leslie, who's the last Leslie on earth, and my mother was a Leslie. And Louise and I are the last of our litter. Louise is about 83 now, and I'll hit 86 in a couple of weeks here.
What day is your birthday?
Hmm?
What day is your birthday?
January 14. and I'll be 86. I've been passing myself off as 86 already because I thought I looked so awfully old to say 85 didn't justify the looks of things. But it's sort of like if you would possess a virtue, you first must assume it. I thought, well, I'll pass myself off as 85. Maybe my body will have to live up to it.